Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, my fine friends. Welcome to another Hullerstubber, this week with archaeologist and Pompeii expert, Dr. Sophie Hay. There's some interesting stuff in this one. It's pretty academic. I think you can enjoy it. I'd hardly mention cocks at all. Oh, maybe a bit. Hope you're enjoying these. We will be keeping them going. Very soon, on the 6th of February, we are doing two Hullerstubbers live stream from the Clapham Grand. Do check out my website, richardherring.com, for details of how you can watch those. They will be coming up on the feed non-live at some point in the future. And do keep checking out twitch.tv/rkherring. Monday night's self-playing snooker tournament, very exciting tournament with 40 players, whittled down to about 24 at the moment. Also, Thursdays, we do Twitch of Fun, my puppet show, with lots of fun extras, largely improvised, nearly entirely improvised, occasional sketches in it. And Wednesday nights, we generally record Hullerstubber, so you can see these before they become podcasts, see them live, see all the stuff we cut out for broadcast, swathes of stuff lost from these shows. If you do watch Twitch and you're with Amazon Prime, you can give us money at no cost to yourselves by linking your Amazon Prime and Amazon Gaming accounts and then coming back every month to subscribe. If you've already undone that, please remember to come back every month and subscribe to someone. That money could help us make loads more content. As always, all that money just goes back into making more stuff for you. It's a win-win situation. Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy Hullerstubber with Dr. Sophie Hay. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man who is now a film star and too good for this. It's Richard Herring. Hello. Welcome. I've come back. It's me, Richard Herring, and welcome to Richard Herring's Last Sighting of Trump podcast. Though I was hanging around with all the living US presidents this week, and all of them with one impeachment or less. They all call it Hullerstubber, so I don't know if that's going to catch on. Be interesting to see. It was good. We're recording this on the day of the inauguration of Joe Biden, President 46. So that's seems positive, doesn't it? But I don't think we've seen the last of him. It's like Darth Vader spinning off, isn't it? In that little thing, he'll be back. Don't you worry. there's a part two coming. That's my guess. Look, I was away last week. If you're watching it live, if you're listening to podcast, it's business as usual. But I was in Wales doing a film. A big film star now. That's the second film I've done in 2 months. I was playing a businessman, a successful businessman whose business has gone down the toilet and who's arrived at a wedding with a sex worker. So, business as usual, tight cast. They didn't tell me about the sex worker part until the last minute. It was improvised. I had a bit of bad luck on the way. On the way there, there it is. Yeah, look, I got lost, and then I drove around about 3 or 4 times looking for this castle we were meant to be in, and got diverted to a place where people were being vaccinated, and I was meant to get a COVID test, so I thought it might be where I was. And I went in and out, and then I drove over one of those spikes that they have to stop you driving the wrong way up a up a road. I just caught it at the back wheel, got a flat, then had to walk up a massive hill carrying all my stuff in the dark, and there were stags and deer all around. I think they should have made a film of that, what happened to me. It was absolutely a disgraceful way to start my film career. It was cold. There was no the central heating wasn't working where we were staying. Does that happen to Brad Pitt? God, I thought I was a big film star. I thought it was all happening. And I just want to talk to you about this. I'll put it up on here because the green screen messes up. Oh, what a giveaway. Okay, it's a green screen. Rather than me sitting in front of President Trump slowly moving away. I noticed this Cif bottle in my bathroom this week. And though I refuse to call it Cif, I call it Jif. In fact, I still call it Vim. Ian Vim invented this, and I don't know why he's allowed the name to change so much. I'll start calling it Cif when you start saying I'll be ready in a siffy, or I just sizzed up all over you. Anyway, the reason it caught my eye, because at the top it says reuse this bottle for life with Cif, Jif, Eco Refills. Now, don't get me wrong, I applaud the innovation of having refills for your sprays in order to cut down the plastic waste. That is a good idea. I just think the idea that I might be using this same bottle for the rest of my life is unrealistic. I think that's setting unrealistic expectations for it. Does Ian Vim, Jif, Cif generally think in 35 years' time the 88-year-old me will be reaching for this same spray bottle? If Ian Jif thinks that, he's living in a fucking dream world. It should say, reuse this bottle a few times with Eco Refills, after which point you know and I know that the slightly complex spray nozzle will have broken after repeated unscrewings and rescrewings. That's still better than buying a new bottle every time. Also, let's be realistic. Some of you are maybe 18 years old and might live for another century. Will Jif even exist by then? I can guarantee you it will have at least changed its name, because we have form for this kind of thing. Maybe it'll be called Biff or Spaff or Fuck. Who knows? We have no respect for your memories or loyalty. Will the Eco Refill still be available in 100 years' time? Will people still have bathrooms and kitchens, or be living hand-to-mouth in a post-apocalyptic nightmare? There are too many parameters for this to have the claim, use this bottle for life. If you get 5 uses out of this bottle, you've done fucking brilliantly. You can pat yourself on the back. If you really care about the planet, I reckon there's probably more ecologically friendly sprays out there than Jif. I remember when it was a powder. Those were the days. Why do they keep changing names of stuff? Call it what it is. Anyway, maybe they wanted to put all that on it, but they couldn't fit it on, so they just went with reuse this. Why stop this? I'm going to hand this down to my children as an heirloom. We could keep this going for 200, 300 years' time. Someone's going to do it. That's going to be the Antiques Roadshow. That'll happen, don't you worry. Right, brilliant. There's more stand-up for you, my fine friends. Hope you enjoyed that. So, look, we're going to crack on with our fantastic guest. She's probably best known as co-author of the paper Roman Barrows and Their Landscape Context, a GIS study at Bartlow, Cambridgeshire. That's why we're all tuning in today. I expect she's sick of talking about the Roman Barrows in Cambridgeshire, so we might talk about something else. Will you please welcome the amazing Dr. Sophie Hay, ladies and gentlemen. How are you?
I'm good.
Do you remember much about the Roman Barrows and their landscape context?
I do. The flashbacks were immediate.
There was quite a lot of papers I could have chosen. That was the most.
I know you went. No, you went for my most popular one, I believe. I get reminded on Academia every week how popular that one is. So it was you looking at it all the time.
It's me looking you up.
Okay, that makes sense now.
Yeah, I got distracted because you have the same name as a porn star. So there was quite a lot of the research that went in the wrong direction before I.
But you brought it back in.
I brought it back to the Roman Barrows. What is their landscape? Just can you sum up what their landscape context is, just for their layman?
They're huge mounds. Yeah. They're huge mounds. Yeah, burial mounds.
Where I live in Cheddar, all the roads are called the Barrows and Barrows Road and Barrows Croft. So I think there were barrows in Cheddar, but they just got leveled so that we could live there.
Exactly. No, it's probably the highest point in Cambridgeshire.
Oh,
I'm guessing.
Wow.
I mean,
it's not very high, is
flat,
it?
So. Yeah. Exactly. So
I mean,
are.
It's no. It's not the. It's the one in Ipswich. Why can I not think of the name of the most famous barrow, the Viking one? You know which one I'm talking
Sutton
about.
Sutton Hoo.
Sutton Hoo. It's no Sutton Hoo, is it?
Yeah. No, it's not. No, no.
Did
no,
you find
no
any big?
No boats.
No. Okay. hey, look, Sophie. It's really lovely to meet you. I don't. I've just followed you on Twitter and think you're brilliant on Twitter. As you know, I'm very interested in Pompeii, and we've been chatting on Twitter every now and again. I've been retweeting you for a long time, it seems. I didn't.
Yeah, you're obsessed with lava.
I'm obsessed with lava. I'm obsessed with volcanoes. How you survive them? How you? Well, there's lots of things, but your Twitter handle is Pompeii79, I recommend everyone follow you because there's lots of great... you're always first with the news, it seems to me, Pompeii, but also other things as well. I liked the piece of information that the Latin for hooray is IO or EO, I don't know how to say it.
Yeah,
and that became the exclamation mark. I learned that
indeed.
From you.
Did you? That's great. Yeah.
I didn't
know.
No,
I like that. Yeah. No, and it was for Saturnalia because that's how they kind of used to say happy Saturnalia.
All I remember, I was obsessed with... I really loved doing Latin at school. I had a great Latin teacher, and this is why I got into Pompeii, because we did those Cambridge courses. Did you do those?
Yes, I'm working on them now.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm going to feature in them.
Are you?
Yeah.
I bought them again. I didn't even do O-level Latin. I worked ahead right to some of the A-level ones because I loved it so much when I was 13 or 14, and then I wasn't allowed to do Latin in my choices, so it was slightly... It would have been quite useful because I did... all I remember is Mr. Moore, our fantastic Latin teacher, made us be farmers, and we had to do the bit that went oige oige agricolae hodie non laborant. That's the only bit I remember, but I was good at Latin for a little
while. That's better than I got. I'm still on Caecilius est in hortus.
Yeah, so Matilla est in artrium.
Yes,
so I do remember some of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Quintus is doing something. He's in the garden.
Yeah,
don't know what that is.
And then Grumio the cook's always getting drunk in the kitchen. He's
it's great. So they're bringing them out again with you featured in them as a Roman, or you just...
I feature as this sort of little archaeologist who gives them sort of top tips about the archaeology behind the story.
Well, it's very fascinating. How did you get into archaeology, first of all? Because to me, I'd rather be an archaeologist than a comedian. So I'm quite jealous of you. Okay, let's give it a go for a year, see how that works out.
Yeah, it works out. A day will do for a minute. Warm up gently. Well, I blame my parents, obviously. They took me on holidays to Greece and Italy. And I kind of fell in love with wandering around ruins and just sort of wondering what they looked like in their heyday. And so I thought, let's go find out. And there's only one way to do that. So.
And so you went to university... And so how did you become an archaeologist? I did some archaeology in my year off, my gap year, in 1985, 1986. And one of them was out of University of Southampton, which is where you were. You're a professor there or you studied there?
Yes. Just a worker.
A worker there.
A worker.
So I was wondering, because that was 85, I was wondering if by the time you were there, whether... people were still talking about me and my great...
All the time. No. It was aspire to be like Richard.
Did you ever work in the Meon Valley when you went out to the...
I didn't, no. No, I think you'd covered it. I think your work there was,
Yeah, probably. I was saying to you beforehand, on my first day, I'd never done archaeology and they didn't tell me what to do. And I started digging up something that I was meant to just leave and put a marker on. But they hadn't really explained it. And then for the rest of the 2 weeks I worked there, he put me on a little Victorian ditch that ran through.
Where you can do no harm.
Yeah, and I found a pin, a Victorian pin. And I kissed a Dutch girl. That's what I imagine it's mainly like, right? It's mainly...
Yes, that's all we do. Yeah. We find pins and kiss Dutch women.
That's what I enjoyed it. It was nice. It was good.
That's why I signed up.
And then I wrote a play about it. It's all good. Did you decide before you went to university that was going to be your career, or did you sort of think, so you knew that it's a... And were you particularly interested in Roman stuff above all else, or did you...
And I think I chose the Romans because they basically went to all the nice places around the Mediterranean.
Yes.
So I, it was kind of like broaden out. I didn't want to do Roman Britain because I thought, well, yeah, being stuck on a moor somewhere in the middle of winter digging is not my bag. So no. I thought I'd choose the guys who went, you know, out into the Med. So I get to go to places like Turkey and the North Africa and Italy, obviously. So, yeah. No, I chose wisely.
Yes, you do. Well, I've read some of your blog. I mean, there's a blog where you talk about going to Uzbekistan and Iran and.
Oh yeah, that was that's more jollying. But, okay. Yeah.
But, yeah. There's a lot of travel.
I don't go jollying on a moor in England. No.
And but. So, is getting a job at Pompeii, which you worked at Pompeii for four years, right?
Yeah.
So is that like the kind of holy grail? I mean, the holy grail is the holy grail of archaeology.
Well,
Did you ever find the holy grail? Because that's
no,
what you're looking.
Lots
you're
of
looking.
The holy parts, okay. But never the grail.
So yeah. Is that the thing that everyone's aiming to do, or can you just say I'd like to go to Pompeii and they go off you go?
No, it's pretty sought after. Yeah. I was very lucky. My job interview for that actually took place in a pub in London, so it kind of set the scene for what was to come. But yeah, no, I had worked there at university for 1 year, and then one of the professors went off to work in Italy, and he said, "Do you want to come?" And well, he actually sent me for 3 months, and I stayed there 4 years. So
terrific.
I just took longer doing the job than was was I was supposed to.
And because there's a lot of Pompeii still that has been unexcavated. Well, what proportion? Because I've been there a few times, and it's massive, and a lot of it's on view for everyone to see. But
yeah,
what proportion?
One third. Ready, right. Hasn't been done. So yeah, 2/3 you can wander around, and 1/3 is still completely covered up to the.
And is the stuff that you were working on, is that open to the public now, or is it a mixture? Or is
it is a bit open. You can walk down the street now, because when I worked there, it was all closed off. But you can peer in. So I was working in a little bar on a corner,
right.
Which is again fitting. So we excavated the bar and the barman's house. Next door, where we found his donkey in the front bedroom. So yeah, there were stories. There's interpretation. we went for the clean version.
Yes. What's the clean version? Because I can only think that he was trying to protect his donkey.
They turned the bedroom into a stable. Okay. And there was a little dog in there as well.
I mean, at the last minute, though, as well, when it's all coming down, you know, you're going to think, okay, well. You know, there's
the
no no one's going to dig us up and put plaster casts and find out what we're up to.
Exactly. Our secret is safe.
So were you working in that one place, the same location for all 4 years, or does it take 4 years? Yeah,
it does take to excavate. It did. And then when I wasn't digging and the dig team had gone away, I was recording the standing buildings and trying to tell the history of the house through the walls, which is where my wall obsession started. They're more interesting than they sound.
I think they are very well. It's quite in archaeology. That's quite. It's unusual to get walls, though, right?
Well, exactly. Well, it's basically you're looking at Roman DIY.
Yeah.
So, but no Sif bottles. Unfortunately. No.
Well, you never know. Did they recycle? Did they recycle bottles?
Well, I know. I was going to say you started off with a good piece of material culture. It's quite impressive. It's what we need from the Roman period: is these people keeping going these objects. So,
yeah. Well, but that's what's fascinating about Pompeii. I guess it is just getting that glimpse of what actual Roman life was like, because obviously all the histories there's some, you know, the Roman culture has at least some documents and things that have survived, but it's all about the leaders, really, isn't it?
Exactly.
In the wars, so you don't really get to find out much about everyday people, and that's what's sort of exciting about Pompeii.
Yeah. No, absolutely, it's like the best opportunity we have to see the layman, the little man on the corner, and the slaves who are completely invisible normally. But yeah, our little barman, you know, we've got a name for him. We found his name.
Right.
It was written on some amphorae, which are those big ceramic vessels for holding wine.
Yeah.
And we found his name written on it. It's like a sort of delivery address, essentially. It's like, so they knew where to dump the wine.
And it said donkey fucker underneath. So you knew it was him. So
it was good. But in Latin.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, exactly. So you can, when you start putting names to people, and then we have a little graffito. So someone in a house has scratched a little face. And he's got a big nose and spiky hair. And by the side of it, it's got the name Amaranthus, which is the name of our Roman.
Okay.
So we've even got technically a kind of little face for him.
You could work it out.
Yeah, so
and
it's quite
do you,
nice for him.
Is his body there or no? So the donkey's there, but
donkey and the dog are there.
He got away.
I found one leg bone, so that could have been him.
Oh, okay. I was going to say he could have got away, but he could have died somewhere else. Well, I was going to talk to you about a few of the developments. So the thing that interested me recently, there's been a couple of developments. I think you've tweeted about both of them, but they found what they're saying is probably a master and a servant escaping. And they say they're probably male, is what it said in the stuff I was reading. One of them's definitely a male, though, Sophie. And nobody except me has mentioned this fact.
You're correct.
Why has nobody mentioned?
Everyone's skirting around that little subject.
Do you not have a duty to that man to just put a? Couldn't you put a bit of cloth? I mean, I know it wasn't you personally we're talking
not
about.
Exactly. I would have got some pixels and placed them casually over the top.
I mean,
I know, poor guy.
Yeah, he was nervous. So you know, it's a little nub there. It's not much to work on.
No.
The main thing might have broken off in there.
Well, exactly. I mean, that would be really sad for him. Yes. Now he's just remembered for only part.
But that's weird, isn't it? I mean, A, when you're working there in Pompeii for 4 years, are you worried about being caught in another volcanic eruption and killed?
All the time.
And B, do you work out what pose you're going to pull for the future archaeologists?
Yes.
And what did
both those things went through my mind.
What did you decide to do?
Right. Well, I was obviously going to have a trowel in my hand. If I wasn't actually on the back of a motorbike escaping pretty fast, I was going to be on site with a trowel in my hand. With some odd things in my pocket so that they would find them and then, you know.
Well, that's a kind of
bamboozled by what I had in my pocket.
That's kind of an archaeologist thing, right? I remember on my first of the two digs I've been. I mean, I don't want to pull rank on you here. But the digs I did in the 1980s, when I'm guessing you were like a child.
Yes.
A guy always buried his boots, pair of boots in amongst, so that future archaeologists would find his boots and be confused. Nice. I don't think they'd be that confused. I think they'd think someone's dug down and put some boots in here.
Yes. Correct.
It seemed a waste of boots.
You had to think
me.
That one through a little harder.
I don't know if he went through with it, because thinking about it, that would have cost him a lot of money in boots.
I hope he didn't do many excavations.
No. I think he did a few. He was called Richard. I remember him because he's called Richard. When you've only done 4 weeks of archaeology, it feels like a long, long time in my life.
Yes.
When I was 18, it was my first time away from home. Somewhere like Pompeii, where you're literally finding almost complete rooms and frescoes, and it must be, were you there at the discovery of anything like amazing like that, or when someone finds something, does everyone go and have a look? Or
we spend our time trotting around seeing what one-upping ourselves on what we found. Absolutely. It's crazy. I mean, I did dig on Salisbury Plain in my university days. So I was just scraping back on chalk, finding dark pits with a piece of fleck of charcoal in it. So I've done that part too. So yes, going to Pompeii was like winning the lottery, really. And we found things like a gold ring with a little stone set in it, which actually had a little horse on it.
Wow.
That I was definitely not doing Roman Britain.
Yeah, that's better than my Victorian pin. I think you're probably a better archaeologist than I am.
I didn't find it, though. I didn't find it. So it was beyond my zone. But no, the donkey is pretty good.
But it's not, you can't sell that.
You can't put a skeleton on eBay. No. Correct.
I would definitely steal some of the stuff. That's why I wouldn't be that good an archaeologist. You found like a load of gold coins, just one.
Yeah.
That's the tax, isn't it? That's the tax. That's a finder's fee.
Payment, yeah. Exactly.
The Romans payment. Would be up for that. And the other, you were working on a bar, but that's not the same bar, the bar that's recently been found. Which is incredibly impressive.
It's insane, yeah. Even for Pompeii standards, it's absolutely unique in Pompeii. It's
so
amazing.
What is it? Why is it unique? And
it's huge.
Right.
Normally bars are just like the level shape with a couple of pots and sort of encased in the bar, but this one seems to have, I think it's 11 pots.
Right.
So they're doing a huge range of food. And in the past, all we've known about the contents of these things is dried food, basically. They found grain and dried fruits and things inside. But this bar, they've started finding bones of animals, which is actually illegal. You're not supposed to really be cooking up meat. There's lots of sort of diktats saying you can't serve hot food or whatever. So this bar's being super naughty anyway.
Right.
But then it's the contents. There was a snail, sheep and fish stew, I think, on the menu, which sounds delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a pork and fish dish of some sort, whether it's a soup or not, we don't know. But the sort of, you know, early surf and turf, if you like.
Right.
But these are amazing to find sort of animal bones and stuff. It's the first time in Pompeii.
Really? Okay.
It's been dug for 250 years. That's pretty cool.
Yes.
And then the frescoes on the bar, obviously, were just amazing. Jaw-droppingly beautiful. I think all I saw on Twitter was everyone saying, I want yellow in my house. And I was like, yeah, already got it. they were stunning. So there's those two sort of dead ducks. So it's kind of like having a bit of a menu on your bar. So, and a very nervous looking rooster who's still alive going, hang on, I'm next for the pop.
And so that was how that was sort of takeaway food. Was that how everyone was kind of getting their food, or was?
Well, a lot of people were. There are a lot of kitchens in Pompeii. I mean, they're not all just eating on the street. There are plenty of kitchens to be seen in Pompeii. Or obviously, right next to the toilet, usually with basically nothing in between.
Right.
So they didn't have the same concept of you need two doors between.
I was in a hotel like that in Swansea once.
They could stir and poo at the same time.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the circle of life, isn't it? It's the circle of food. Exactly. Might as well have it all in one place.
Straight in and out.
And was it at this bar that the there's graffiti on this bar saying Nissia shameless shitter? Is that the...
Yes.
So that is that the person who ran the...
That's what they're thinking, yeah. He's a Greek. Right. He's a Greek guy. He's not native to Pompeii. But yes, obviously loved by his clients.
It sounds like they were all pretty shameless shitters, if that's the way that the toilets work. It's quite a specific... I mean, that's... Again, it's history. You're not expecting in 2,000 years' time or whatever to have this thing still going. You know, that guy going, oh, fuck, I'm never going to live this down. But at least when I'm dead, as he was dying, I was thinking, oh, at least that's over. No, never going to stop saying I'm a shameless shitter. And then turning up. Oh, look at this.
Look, everyone, gather round.
And so there's a lot of sort of rude stuff around Pompeii, right? So the Romans were quite obsessed with the penis, which I find very childish of them.
Yes. Well, indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
But what was the in my short show Talking Cock, I used the hic habitas felicitas. There's a picture of a, which I think is from Pompeii, isn't it? But it's certainly
a
Roman thing. So
it was actually found above a baker's oven.
Okay.
So it was kind of, you know, wishing luck to the bread being cooked.
So why? What was the logic? You know, what the logic behind putting cocks everywhere was for the Romans?
Well, you have to remember it's a very male society. Okay. So the most sort of robust male symbol is obviously the penis. But in fact, they use it as a sort of good luck. I mean, obviously, there's pornography as pornography, but most of the time when you just have a random phallus hanging off a wall or on a paving stone or in a wind chime lamp, I mean, they are pretty ubiquitous throughout society.
Mm-hmm.
These are more to ward off evil.
Right.
So it's the fasciculus, which is the divine embodiment of the phallus.
Okay.
And basically, they're there to ward off the evil eye. So it's like, you know, crossing your fingers when you walk under a ladder or whatever. It's protecting yourself.
Okay.
Which is why they're everywhere and on crossroads, so that no accidents and things.
Okay. And do you think boys...
And that's their story and they're sticking to it.
Do you think the fact that, you know, now, you know, kids just draw, boys draw those in the condensation window, do you think it's the same thing passing down?
I absolutely do. I think there's that on that scale, very little has changed.
Okay.
For men, obviously.
Yeah. Yes. I don't know, you know. I'm not that obsessed with my penis.
No.
All of them in general.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And what I find quite, because obviously there's a lot of Roman literature that has been lost. There's amazing things have survived, but lots and lots of things haven't survived or survived in parts or, you know, been quoted in other sources. Is there any chance that in that third of Pompeii and whatever's left in Herculaneum, that we'll discover all these lost works of...
I would love there to be a library in Pompeii that's excavated. I think if you ask most archaeologists, that's what they would say.
Yeah.
Although I'd like the planning office, because obviously looking at walls, I'd quite like to know that happens. But no, the library would be amazing. But the fact is, in Pompeii, probably wouldn't get that much surviving if it's on a scroll.
Right.
We don't have any scrolls like they do in Herculaneum. We have some tablets, which are just blocks of wood with wax, which they would have written on. And we can see what the wax is obviously melted in the slight increase in temperature during the eruption.
Yes.
But the wood has carbonized and we can see the scratching marks. So we can read those. But scrolls would be just incinerated.
Right. But the ones in Herculaneum...
Herculaneum survived, yeah.
And you can read those... with
very
X-ray.
Slowly, yes.
Yeah. And are they are they books or are they in the Herculaneum? Are they books or are they
scrolls? Yeah. So in the olden days, they used to try and unfurl them, and
yeah.
That would, you know, they would take sort of 5 years to unfurl 2 centimeters or something. And now, obviously, they have cool technology where they basically scan them, and they recognize ink letters, and they can just you can read the whole thing without even without unraveling it, which is really cool. The sad thing about that is that they're all quite boring. Sort of texts, and the guy's library was basically he was a fan of one author, so everyone's sort of sitting there waiting for the missing book of, you know, Suetonius or whatever. They're not going to get it.
No.
They're going to have more boring philosophy from one guy, Philodemus.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. Some fan of mine will just have my books, my five, seven or eight books, and nothing else, and
exactly.
Somehow that will survive and that will be passed down. The ages.
Exactly.
That's what you've got to hope for.
Well, that's all you can hope for.
So I'll ask you a version of an emergency question, but it's about Pompeii.
Okay.
If you could take away from Pompeii one item that they would have said, you're allowed to, you've done so much great work, Sophie, we're going to let you keep one thing and take it home with you. And it can be a fresco or anything. It can be an item. What thing from that's been discovered in the whole of Pompeii and all the history of Pompeii?
Ooh.
What would you? Is it the bloke with his cock out? Is that what you're choosing?
Obviously, kind of bloke. Oh my god! No one's ever asked me that question before.
No,
I hang out with too many respectful.
It's not stealing. They're saying you're such a good archaeologist. They must have done that to Indiana Jones. They must have gone, you're allowed to keep the ark. We'll let you keep one Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I probably would then. I would choose the little graffito of my barman. I think.
Oh,
that would be my take home.
That's
yeah.
not worth. It. You could have got something worth loads of money.
Okay. But then I wouldn't be keeping it. I'd be just putting it on eBay. Yeah, some massive gold bowl.
Or all the massive, you could have one of those wonderful, you could have a mosaic or all the walls.
I know, look what I've done. I've just...
little graffito.
What would you steal? What would you steal?
I don't know, from Pompeii.
Give. I don't know what the word is.
It's not stealing because they've said I can have it. Yeah. I would... it is a good question. I guess I like the and you were tweeting about this the other day about the dogs all having the same collars, but I like the little mosaic of the dog, the famous one.
Okay, yeah,
I've got that on
Carvey,
a little thing somewhere.
Carvey Carnum.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I'll probably
take
that. I
think we've all got it somewhere on something.
Then I could stick that outside my front door because I have got a dog, and you do have to be aware of it because she barks at you and stuff. Well, but she's not too bad. She's not too bad. Great. So I was going to ask you this, another emergency question based on Pompeii. Have you ever seen a ghost in Pompeii? Did you ever see a ghost? Because if they're ghosts, they'd have to be ghosts in Pompeii.
I was always amazed they didn't do ghost tours.
Right.
It's like if this was in England, it would be a whole thing going on. The Italians don't seem to get ghosts.
Right.
And they just don't believe them. And I've been in Pompeii a few times at night. And obviously there's no street lighting, so you are kind of wading around in the dark. And I was praying that I would see one. I'd love to, or just heard an agonising scream or something. It doesn't sound that nice, but no, sadly not.
No. I think if there's no ghosts in Pompeii, there can't be ghosts, because that is...
Well, exactly.
Like, no, they all died in horrible pain and with unfinished business.
Exactly. No, I agree. But no, there's no culture of it, and I've tried, honestly.
Maybe they just didn't like living underground all that time when there were ghosts, and they thought, oh, screw this, we'll go on somewhere else. And then they got dug up. If we'd only waited a few...
It's patience.
And so do you feel like, obviously, as... Pompeii's been sort of excavated over several centuries, really, hasn't it? And there were medieval people trying to get in there and nick things.
Yeah, no.
And so how much has been lost by poor archaeology through history?
Well... Yes, a lot.
And just that,
is
that just that
politely?
Yeah.
It's the 250 years worth of sort of official excavations, I should say. It's been dug for different reasons over a long period. So originally, things were just being carted off if they looked nice, but the archaeology, the little details, like we're looking at bones in a pot, they were not interested in that at all. So there's a massive missing element to our work, which is why I think, thank goodness there is still one third.
Yeah. And do you
underground,
feel...
we can wait till we can do this properly.
Do you feel that though maybe in 200 years time archaeology will be even better and that you're missing out loads of stuff?
Yes, I do all the time.
You should stop digging
so
stuff
just
up.
Stop.
We should all stop until we definitely got to the best at being archaeology we can get.
Exactly.
Because they might be able to like bring people back to life in 200 years' time. They might be able get a bit of DNA and they might be able to travel back in time.
Now we're doing Jurassic Park.
They might be able to. And then you've wasted it. You could have got your bomb and you could have been back.
Who needs ghosts when you have the real people? Yeah, what a waste.
And even in the time you've been working, there must have been huge advances. In terms like we're talking about the reading those scrolls.
God. Yeah, so, yeah, no. Even while I was there, I started off hand drawing walls, and now they get a piece of kit and they scan them, and you can see, the tiny little granules in a pebble. It's like, oh, geez, okay. Yeah, so no, it's sort of gone leaps and bounds. But we shouldn't ever really lose track of what we're recording and why. I think that's my sensible hat on, is that, without looking at things properly, if we just scan things and go home, we're missing quite a lot.
Yeah, okay.
That's my story.
Okay, good point. And do you have any strong feelings about what the date of the eruption of Vesuvius was?
Very strong. Yes, I'm team pomegranate, I believe.
Okay.
which means the autumn date.
Okay.
So yes, the traditional date, 24th of August, based on one letter written by the eyewitness, so you'd think reliable, but not so much, because we've only got copies of this letter written by Pliny the Younger, and medieval scribes were a bit rubbish.
Yeah.
And so they just, when it wasn't clear, they just kind of looked around the room and then filled in any date. So we have, I think we have the 24th of August. We have the 25th of October. I think we even have a 5th of December somewhere hanging around. But the 24th letter became kind of canon because it was the best preserved. And then we just decided that was that. But then since then, we've got sort of proper archaeological evidence, we believe, that says it can't have happened in August because you've got ripe pomegranates.
Yeah.
And they only ripen at the end of September earliest. But we've also got some really, basically the sludge on the floor in a wine press. So when they finished pressing the wine and it sort of splattered everywhere, they actually found all of that kind of sludge still on the floor. So that sort of suggests it was after the grape picking, which again doesn't happen till October. So for us, really, the date is kind of October-y date.
Okay.
And then in the new excavations, there was that little graffito which had the 17th of October, but whoever wrote it didn't write the whole date. So we just have that number and the month, but we don't have the year. So it's kind of that tantalizing another bit of evidence without being confirmed.
But again, you would think, cool. I suppose, with all the stuff that's churning up, you'd think someone would just have had like a desk calendar, one of those block ones. Just with the date.
Exactly. Just let it there. That would have been really useful.
Or if you find, you know, in record, you would think in records there would be something with, you know, if you're finding papyri, you know, the wax tablets, you'd think there'd be something with the date on.
Well, exactly. That morning could have just signed off. Yeah. Oh, so close, and yet.
So they're probably. So
we're left with pomegranates as a result.
What if the hot gas from the volcano coming up through the earth just made everything ripen a bit early that year? What about that?
Yeah. Well, then you're right.
I think it was before August.
You just cracked the code. Damn. Should have come straight to you.
And do you think is having the, I mean, there's sort of first-hand account, because Pliny the Elder died in the in the explosion, but it's his account. He was the one who sort of went in there. And then did he tell someone else about it who told Pliny the Younger about it?
Well, no, Pliny the Younger, well, kind of, yeah. The Younger was watching it. So, I mean, that's...
But from a long way off, though. He was miles away.
Well, it's...
He was doing his... I've just had a book about it. He was asked if he wanted to come along. Yeah. And he said, no, I'm the younger one. You go. You're the Pliny the Elder. You go. Why? People will think we're the same bloke eventually for a long time. I've got to do my A-levels. So you go and look at the volcano. And Pliny the Elder, who did a big natural... Who did this big stupid encyclopedia that is boring and wrong.
Generally. Don't follow his medical advice.
He wanted to go and look at it for his... He wanted to go and look at it a bit closer, which I think was probably his first mistake. I think if there's a volcano, go further away from it. That's why he died. But if he died, then how do we know what he did?
Well, so we have people around him who then reported back, and there were enough people who...
And one of them said, say it was the 24th of August.
Yeah.
It'll be funny.
Yeah, watch them.
That's pretty unusual to have like a eyewitness account of something, and is that something you use? Is something that confirms what you're finding? I mean, because there's quite full on description of the ocean filling with stone and whatever,
and the sea sort of, you know, vaguely tsunami esque, just sort of reaching out. But yeah, the description of the actual of what the eruption looked like ended up being called a Plinian eruption.
That's right.
Because he was the first to kind of observe it, and there's, you know, a sort of smoke column going 30 kilometers into the air. It was, you know, pretty striking and looking like an umbrella pine tree, he calls it. Otherwise, you know, without this description, we'd never have had a clue really what it actually looked like, and we would have assumed that there was lava, which there wasn't. And that is the hill I will die on, literally, probably. one day.
It's dangerous work. Why? Because they were back, the Romans came back and lived there almost straight away again, where they kind of stayed away for about a couple of years and then went,
and we forget, there's often, you know, there's talk of all the people who died there, but actually there's a lot of survivors.
Yeah.
And people who did just look up and went, not looking good, let's leave. And they kind of, they settled in and around sort of the Bay of Naples area. They didn't go far, let's say.
Right.
So they, you know, they weren't that scared. but essentially, the land is really fertile.
Yeah.
So after an eruption, it's still fertile. So yeah, come back. Stop growing.
How often does it erupt? So was it during the Second World War it last erupted? So
yeah,
how often does it go off?
Well, that's it. It doesn't really have a kind of rhythm.
Right.
So that's the fun part. So when I was there, we had 6 earthquakes or something in about 3 months.
Yeah.
And of course, before the eruption in Pompeii in 79, there was a massive earthquake in 62 or 63. Another date we don't know.
Right.
Another date that we can have fun with. But so I was kind of like looking at my watch at that point going, well, yeah, maybe. If history's taught me one thing, let's
get
stop.
Out.
Yeah.
Go the other way. Go the other. Don't go towards the volcano.
No,
that's what
exactly.
I've learned.
I would go to the library somewhere else.
If I had to die in a natural disaster, though, I think I'd like to go in a volcano. If it had, that was at least.
Well, I mean, the way they died, it's obviously terrifying for ages and ages, as you know, it's a 24-hour eruption. So they're kind of thinking, we're safe. And then it kind of peters off a bit. And then suddenly these pyroclastic surges come down the hillside. And they don't know what happened after that. So I think there's about 5 or 6 of these things. And Pompeii actually gets hit on the 3rd, 4th, and 5th, I think.
Right.
And so if you're still there, if you're still hanging on after the third and fourth.
I mean, that's brave, isn't it? That's, in a way, that bloke deserves to have his cock shown on the BBC, doesn't he? Because he should have got out a bit quicker. He was he had two going. Oh, there's two. That'll probably be it.
Actually, he died before because he was slightly north. Yeah, yeah. I think he was in the number 4th surge. Yeah, right. So he was already dead and people in Pompeii were still alive. But I find that kind of weird as well. It's like they were still running around going, you know, it could be okay. And Mr. Man over there is still not okay.
And so how is the life of an archaeologist? Is it... because again, I have a very brief experience of it as an 18-year-old, and it seemed like a lot of drinking and cavorting around, and everyone seemed a bit crazy.
Yeah,
is that sort of how it was for you?
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, we're an odd breed.
So is it a bit like being, do you feel like you're still being a student for all that time, or does it feel like a job?
A real job.
You're being very sensible and doing, you know, proper stuff.
Proper
engineering
stuff.
And stuff. I don't understand any of that. I just know about looking at Victorian trenches. That's my main thing. But
there's the sort of the university stage of being an archaeologist. And then, yes, you have to take a little bit of responsibility. And I worked for 14 years doing survey work. So geophysics survey work for you know, important clients. So you do grow up eventually. And you don't stop drinking, but you do grow up.
And is it a young person's game? Do you get like 70 and 80 year old archaeologists still out there bending over in the dirt?
Well, they're not much. Yeah, there's not many bending anymore. I got out of field archaeology a few years ago because I thought, I think it's time. My knees are going.
Yeah.
So I thought I'll write books now. That's safe.
Well, at least you're in.
I don't get dirty.
At least you're in Italy, where at least presumably it wasn't too. The weather was quite nice.
Exactly.
No,
you can still dig. There's people who are older than me out there in the field. But yeah, I decided no. I've had enough. I'm shocked.
And so, what are you doing? You've moved back to London now.
I have.
And so, how are you passing your time, both in lockdown and outside of lockdown? What do you?
Well, they're one in the same. It's the joy of a freelance. So I'm working with Cambridge University on the Caecilius books.
Yes.
So I'm sort of helping that. We're actually making a sort of offshoot of that with our bar owner. We've created a story for a kids' history course, basically. And we've had it illustrated, and we've got Caroline Lawrence. I don't know if you know Caroline Lawrence, but she writes these amazing history books about the Roman period. So we've been working with them to do that, which is, and it will go out free to schools. We're not charging for it.
Terrific.
So that's being launched this year, I think, summer this year.
Do schools still learn Latin, though? Is that a big thing?
Yeah, so, it's great. It's, yeah, they're weird. I mean, everyone's trying to keep that up. But ours is pure history. It's not learn Latin. it's just kind of learning. It's like the Caecilius thing, but it's sort of learn history, but also how do we know about history? How are these stories kind of manifest themselves? We've got objects that we pull out of the ground, so tell the story. And then I'm writing a book off my own bat about the women who excavated in Pompeii, who are now largely forgotten.
Yes, I saw you writing an article. Cool. So who give me some examples of
okay, well, the first one I can find really is Napoleon's sister.
Right.
Who's pretty cool. And I always thought, you know, she would just sort of swan onto site and have a look. She married a general in Napoleon's army, and then he became king in Naples. So at the beginning of the 19th century. And I thought, you know, the story was she would go and swan around and, you know, pretend to dig something up. They would kind of bury things for her, and then she would come and brush away the pumice stone. And I thought that's all she did. And then I found some bits and pieces, and I sort of discovered that she'd actually kind of went, actually, this was fun digging up fake stuff. I'd like to dig up the real stuff. So she actually got herself a little excavation going. And then she basically just took charge of the strategy of digging Pompeii.
Right.
And she got Napoleon's army to come and dig the walls, the circuit wall of Pompeii, which is why you can see the wall now.
Yeah.
Because that she thought also that they had no skills, so they couldn't do much damage to a big, hefty city wall. And she was correct. Even Sulla couldn't do much damage to that city wall. So the French army were fine. But then she decided that, you know, people were digging little holes everywhere at that period, and they were just carting stuff off. And she was like, well, it's got no sense to it. Let's open it up to the public. Let's open up all these streets so people can walk around. And, you know, quite amazing stuff at the beginning of the 19th century. And nobody knows that she had any part in this. So I'm like, right, I'm going to tell her story. She's cool.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, I think it is. I just think Pompeii is such a magical place, and such a place, you know, it really got me interested in history. And the first time I went there, I was just sort of overwhelmed with it, I have to say. As an 18-year-old, I couldn't believe it. But I think also a lot of it was to do with having studied that and having those, however accurate they were, of Caecilius and who he was.
Yeah,
but is there a bust of Caecilius? There's an actual.
There is, there's a herm, with a little penis. So,
yes, is there?
Yeah, you should know that one well.
I didn't know, is it his penis there that they've...
Well, not the actual one, no. It's made of bronze. But I'm sure it was modelled to scale, yeah. I'm sure the artist got it correct. But no, that's the nice thing about Pompeii is it sort of gives you the whole the gamut of Roman life. It's perfect. But then for me now, I kind of feel like it's giving me a sort of idea about the history of the excavation. So I'm looking at a Russian woman who came over from, you know, she escaped the Russian Revolution. She's there in the 1920s. Mussolini's about to come in and dig. And so it's also just bigger than just the Roman city.
Sure.
Now. I'm kind of finding it quite interesting finding out about how it was dug and why we are seeing what we see in what is missing, like we were talking about earlier, what's missing from the picture. It's great. But yeah, the Roman city on its own, my first time there, I was just, you know, I'd been walking around Roman British sites, no offence, but they're quite low, low to the ground. And then suddenly, you know, to be walking in a street where you've got the walls and you just feel sort of enveloped by it, which is so cool.
Sure. And are there other things to come out of Pompeii that you know about? Is there because there must be that with that bar as an example, it's obviously been fully excavated by the time we, the public, see it. So there must be other sort of secrets that are sort of.
Well, there are, but they don't tell me.
No, do they not?
I even work for the official Pompeii Twitter feed.
Yes.
And they don't tell me any secrets at all.
Because you tweet
They literally give it to me on the day and they say, can you do something with this? And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So I hear at the same time you guys hear pretty much. So yeah, no, it's a well-kept secret what's going on in Pompeii. But rightly so, because then it's pretty amazing when it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, grabbing headlines left, right and centre.
And if you could travel back in time, the whole lot of you, not just your finger, which is what I usually ask, what period of what period of
wow.
I usually ask if you have a finger that could travel through time, what would you do with it? But you're a serious academic. I'm not going to ask you
a
crazy question like that. You can all go back. Which would you go back to Roman history? And if so, what period of history? Or would you go back some? Where would you go to if you could? Would it be to the eruption?
If I wasn't being boring, I would go. I would probably go to Persepolis and just see these crazy sort of festivals that they had there with the sort of the Persian kings. But if I'm being boring, I would love to go back, obviously pre-eruption, and I'd like to go back to my little corner Pompeii, where you know, if I spent 4 years there, I'd quite like to spend a day there, you know.
And what was he serving up? So he was only serving up one pot of stuff, was he, in your...
Well, he was pretty cool. He didn't have any pots, so that's he didn't really do food, but his wines were really exotic. So we found all the amphorae in the beer garden at the back, and one of them came from Gaza.
Wow,
and it's okay. The only one known in Pompeii from Gaza.
Right.
So he's obviously got a sort of roving eye for exotic wines. Obviously looked at his neighbours and went, oh, they're all selling kind of local plonk. I need to do something different. I think outside the box. So he brought in Cretan wines in his outside the stable where the donkey was, in his atrium where Metella was hanging out.
Yeah.
He had something like 30 to 40 Cretan wine amphorae. So he was bringing in from Crete, Gaza. So he was kind of a bit more interesting than your average wine.
And is it the same as wine? Is it the same? Is wine the same from 2,000 years ago? Or are you able to tell? No.
It would have been a bit rougher, I think. But apparently the alcohol level was the same. I've just been reading a friend's tweet about this. But because they used wild yeast to make it. But
okay.
It never really got super alcoholic. But they did water it down,
right?
Probably more because it tasted a bit grim. I did actually have to taste some sort of essentially authentic Roman wine on a TV program I did, and I hadn't drunk it before. So they put me behind the bar with a glass of wine in my hand, and I basically spat it out over the guy who was interviewing me. It was disgusting.
Okay.
So take two. He had to sort of brush down the wine off him. But yeah, no, it's very sweet, I think, is the main thing. It's sort of unusually yucky sweet.
And what are the things, do you think? Because what's fascinating is, you know, that it's 2,000 years, but I suppose that's only 50 or 60 generations of people, I suppose. Is it that many? Were there things that surprised you that are the same or nearly the same as the modern day?
I think the one that got me the most was the boiler. It was crazy. I was looking through a book and I found a picture and I said, well, what is that? And it looks exactly, and this is what everybody said on Twitter, was that looks like the boiler I had in my bedsit in the 1960s. It's basically a metal cauldron with pipes coming out of it. And it was just exactly like your boiler would look today.
Right.
And that's when you suddenly think, yeah, we have not progressed very far when the boilers look exactly the same.
Yeah.
I think that was the sort of most what moment. I wasn't expecting that.
Cool. Great. Well, look, it's been lovely to talk to you. I'm disappointed you can't give me any more secrets that are coming up. Let me just check out.
Well, I'd have to kill you if I knew. No, we're all in the dark.
If people want to follow you, Pompeii 79, really loads of great updates and really interesting articles. Some of them are in Italian, though. So
yes.
You have to be able to speak Italian.
But boiler speak, so, you know, anyone who's a fan of boilers, follow me.
And we'll look out for your Caecilius book and your Women of
My Women in Pompeii.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, give a massive round of applause virtually to the fantastic Dr. Sophie Hay. Thank you very much. See you next week. We've got Ashley Story. I've just booked Ashley Story for next week. And tomorrow, more Twitch of fun if you're watching this live. Okay, see you everyone. Thank you very much. Goodbye. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Dr. Sophie Hay. Thank you to Pest for playing the music. I'm indebted to Chris Evans, not that one. Ben Walker, fantastic producer, working hard for us on ad content at the moment. Thank you very much to everyone at Acast and the British Comedy Guide and everywhere else that helps us. Yeah, this is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Why not become a monthly badger? GoFasterStripe.com/badges. Loads of extra content, loads of fun things that you get, including a badge and a membership pack and all sorts of stuff. And again, all your money goes straight back into providing more entertainment for you at home. Love you all. Take care of yourselves and each other. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, richardherring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It will make me feel sad.